This is Professor Allen, and welcome to the Quarter Bin. In every episode of this podcast, I will summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a single issue from my comic book collection, which I will select sort of at random. Any book from my comic collection is eligible, as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for it, at least for the time being. Was the issue worth 25 cents? Was it a bargain at 25 cents? Or was it still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this 145th episode of the Quarter Bin, we are starting a two-episode, four-issue look at another dead universe. So far, we've knocked out the Ultraverse, Amalgam, Milestone, New You, Techno Comics, and Vertigo. And, as a result of a Twitter vote, we are starting a two-episode look at the Kirby Universe line of books from Topps Comics. And so this episode, we'll be looking at Secret City Saga number 0 and Bombast number 1, both from Topps Comics, and both cover dated April 1993. But first, a little feedback. You may remember that last episode, we had a chat. We talked about options for expanding, possibly, potentially, the definition of quarter bin in terms of the types of comics I could cover on the show. Speaking of Twitter polls, there was also a Twitter poll on this subject, which generated a range of comments as well. So I'm going to just go over all of the comments here and now, and then we'll discuss the results of the poll in a few minutes, and then address what I'm thinking about this discussion and how it will affect the podcast, if at all, as we roll into the future. Now, as you might expect, the irrelevant shag had a emotional tantrumy outburst with the reaction of, "What is this shenanigans? You teach economics? Is the definition of a quarter variable on your tests? As variable as the shows you appear on the so-called Fire and Water podcast feed, shag." Now, Tom Panarese raised the subject of another person who might not be thrilled with these discussions. "Stella will flay you for this." Well, fortunately, she doesn't listen to any of our shows, so there is that. And Nathaniel Wayne gave us a calm and quiet, understated comment as well in an email entitled, "Hashtag Betrayal." Dear Benedict Arnold, so it's come to this. A complete and total rebuke of everything that the Quarter Bin once stood for. Look upon your works, ye mighty, and despair. Oh, the humanity. Have you no decency, sir? Is this not, in fact, a quid pro quo? Hey, is Nathaniel hinting that he has started a secret impeachment inquiry of this podcast without putting that to a full vote of the listeners? Anyway, actually, he did calm down in the second half of his message. Okay. Now that I got that out of my system, seriously, Prof, do whatever helps you sleep at night. I'll keep listening and enjoying however you decide to move forward. Just realize that Stella and Shag will never let you hear the end of it. Geekily yours, Nathaniel Wayne. So right on Stella and Shag, buddy. I mean, does the podcasting constitution allow me to impeach listeners? I mean, check with the Latverian Attorney General, Paul Spitero. Get a ruling on that one. Jeremiah Jones Goldstein from comics.blog made a fine, wise, and nuanced point. "I thought the recent Ghost Rider episode, a reprint of two comics for 50 cents, totally qualified too. Personally, I think anything from the dollar bin or less should qualify. Call it inflation or something along those lines." Well, dollar might be a bit extreme, JJG, but I'll be honest. I like the spirit of this comment, and I like the support. Karen from Between the Pages made an interesting point. I think anything from the library, Hoopla, DCU, Marvel Unlimited, or Comixology Unlimited qualifies. I also have zero problems with anything from the comic book Circle of Life counting. So again, I like that support. I did talk about the free comics that lovely listeners have sent me over the years and why I don't include those. And I think I'm going to stick to my guns on at least that. But I certainly do appreciate those thoughts and comments. Karen also followed up and asked if the LCS still had those amazing bundles that I covered in Quarterbin 100. Those were 50 book stacks for $7 each. And no, unfortunately, that store closed down a few years ago. We heard from TARDIS Rider, who was listening to this episode the night before the Twitter poll came out. I support the idea of expanding the concept. I don't know what Hoopla is, but libraries often have great collections of not just new trade paperbacks, but great collections of classic comic strips. That would be worthy of coverage as well. After I explained what Hoopla is, the writer replied, "My library system uses something similar, but I think it has a different name." We agreed that was probably Overdrive, which actually M prefers, or at least uses more often, but I'm a Hoopla fan myself. TARDIS Rider did reply and confirm that they've used Overdrive to stream audiobooks in the past. Now, on the other side of that argument was Laurel, aka Mountainflower One, from the Hunters podcast, who talked about library materials. "I love using libraries, but I'm not sure it's free because they buy the book or pay a usage fee, and libraries are funded through our taxes. Now, it might be less than a quarter, perhaps, but we still do pay for it, just trying to keep the show honest." Look, if I wanted this many women to keep me honest, I'd be a bigamist. But that is a fair point, Laurel. Although as an employee of the state of Ohio, almost all the money I spend, no matter what I spend it on, comic books or not, if you track it back far enough, pretty much does come from taxpayers. Mike Peacock from Justice's First Dawn shared his unique Michigan perspective on discount books. Just saying, my nearest LCS has 31 cents. Boxes. By necessity, I will have to vote for the closest version, which is three for a dollar. And again, I assume what Mike is talking about here is a sales tax situation, that the 31 cent pre-tax price works out to a customer-friendly, easy-to-use after-tax price of three for a dollar. Both Billy D. and Mike from Comics in the Golden Age allowed us how they approved of all three possible expansions, and of course responses like that one do make interpreting the Twitter poll a bit tricky, where people had to only pick one, although again many did express support for multiple of those choices. And from the Great White North, a man who stands on guard for thee, Ranger Gord, came to my defense on all of this. "I truly have to defend the honor of our professor and his economic acumen." And just to show you how serious Gord is, he spelled honor with a U, because Canadian. As we should all know, his purchases are made in Latverian currency, which by the nature of that regime's stability and good standing in the world far exceeds the values of paltry U.S. currency and many other planetary denominations. So the quarter virtue is solid, as the change from the professor's comics acquisitions provide the world's economy with a much-needed shot in the arm. Without Doombucks, we'll all be selling apples on the corner for devalued American quarters, which are worth about 10 cents in Canada. Finally, someone who gets me. Gord, I mean, someone who really, really gets me. Now, as I said on Twitter, I gave four options for possibly expanding the mandate of the show, specifically in the definition of quote-unquote quarterbin. They were three for a dollar books, free trades from the public library or Hoopla, old public domain comics, and the last choice specifically for Stella was no, no, no. And the results were interesting and perhaps, at least to me, a little surprising. They were, again, certainly surprising to me, and I thank all the voters who participated. We ended up with 49 votes, and the clear winner, with 40% of those votes, was Three for a Dollar Books, which really surprised me. That one I put in there sort of as the dummy variable, the option that was so outrageous, so on its face, not quarter bin-ish, that it made the other option seem less wild, less out of bounds. But the listeners have spoken. So I will certainly take Three for a Dollar. I've always joked that they are sort of honorary quarter bins. And maybe with 6.5 years of inflation and Latverian to U.S. to Canadian currency, maybe. Maybe. Next up, tied with 12 votes each, was what I call the Stella option, no, 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 never, 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 and the library and Hoopla trades. Now, these people, I suspect, are the 25-cent purists, and I do respect them very much, although I imagine that the no, no, no votes, which is Stella and Shag tweeting from multiple accounts, you know how many podcast accounts both of them have access to. I mean, I'm just saying. And lastly, with 6 votes, was the one that to me was the clearest case. The one I would have voted for. No, I did not vote on my own poll. And that was public domain comics available online. I put those there because they are the ones most readily available to the most number of people. And they're always and absolutely and forever free. Even more free than the library. See, Laurel? I'm paying attention. Luke Giaconetti volunteered to join me on an episode of The Quarter Bin if I ever wanted to dabble in comics from that particular source, the free public domain area. So, before I address those results directly, I do want to point out a couple of listeners who made additional proposals. Slangword Scott said that books with an original cover price of 25 cents or less would work for him. Now, in my mind, that is kind of a cool idea, like a time-traveling version of The Quarter Bin. If there only were a comic book time machine type of podcast that existed, I would let that show do that. But if a show like that doesn't exist or once did exist but, you know, faded away and hardly ever puts out new episodes, then maybe I could pick up that slack with this original 25 cents. I like that. A book that was once a quarter bin book. You'd think that could qualify, right? I mean, that's interesting. And Iowa's Joe, he said that he thought a lot of trades would be acceptable. A trade for cheap might well average 25, maybe 30, 35 cents an issue. And there are actually a few of these in the database already. A few of those very cheap trades I've gotten over the years from Ollie's or one or two from Half Price Books. Now, these ones that I'm talking about truly do meet the quarter rule. But of course, if it became a 31-cent rule or a 3-for-a-dollar rule, probably a few more of those physical trades that I've purchased over the years would qualify. So I thank everybody for the feedback, and I don't know what I'm doing just yet. I just wanted to get your thoughts. I think I am going to broaden the mandate of the show in some ways. Just, again, I'm not going to be getting new quarter books into the database, and that is always part of the fun. But I don't know where or when. I don't have specific plans to do anything like this at any particular point in time. But I do appreciate the discussion, and I appreciate everyone's viewpoints. I mean, except Shag, obviously. He's from Florida. But I think I can promise this. Whenever I cover a book on the show that meets one of these new criteria, I will reveal that fact. I will mention that. In other words, if I don't point that out in a particular episode, then those books would still be in the original mandate. At least that's what I'm thinking for now. Now, we did get some actual feedback on the actual story from last episode, that actual comic, Four Color Comics 1253, aka Spaceman number one. But I'm going to hold off on that feedback until next episode. I do want to thank the folks who gave social media love for that episode, including all the people mentioned above, and also Paul Hicks, Kirk Spencer, Clinton from Coffee and Comics, Ed Moore from Teal Productions, Paul from The Collected Edition, Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us, Herman from The Long Box of Darkness, Drew from Comics for Fun and Profit, and also the office down the hall and around the corner from me on campus, and Al Sedano from the Warlock Thanos podcast. Thanks to everyone for that support. Now, I definitely think that we all need to calm down and digest this information and think about the possible policy changes that could be coming to the show. I know that change is hard, and there's a lot to think about here, so let's take a break to do that. And when we come back, we'll talk about some books from the Kirbyverse from Topps Comics.
Hey, Brian.
What's up, Paul?
Do you like comic books?
I do. I love the funny books.
Do you like listening to people talk about comic books?
Why, yes, Paul. I find that both entertaining and informative.
Well, that's great, because there's a new podcast where each episode, a famous run or story arc is discussed in detail in a fun and totally not rambling way. It's called The Collected Edition.
The Collected Edition? That sounds intriguing. Who are the hosts?
Well, that's the best part. It's us, Paul Matthew Carr and Brian Reese.
What? Fantastic! I love us. We're awesome. Where can folks find this amazing podcast, Paul?
Well, I'm glad you asked. The Collected Edition can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com.
That's great. I'm going there right now.
Me too.
And we're back. And first up on today's double feature, we get Jack Kirby's Secret Saga number 0, which had a cover price of... Wait. This can't be right. Free? Meaning I acquired this book at a literally impossible to calculate markup price appreciation? Man, oh man, this is what happens. You talk about maybe changing the parameters of the show, and this is the hand that fate deals me? A free comic that I paid 25 cents for? Shocking. But we can persevere. The cover of this free comic by Walt Simonson shows three Kirby-esque characters running straight at us in Kirby-ish sort of poses. There are the requisite geometric shapes and lines, the circles. I'm not saying you would mistake this for the king, but you can certainly see the influence of Kirby, the references that are being made here. Now, on the inside front cover, we have a chart that visualizes the 12 issues of this event, along with this explanation. Once upon a time, when a new comic book debuted, you simply had to buy the first issue, and then the second, and then the third, etc. Nowadays, it ain't that easy. What with zeros and multiple first issues, it's easy to get lost. We at Topps Comics have put together the chart below to make your journey through the latest Kirby comics a little easier. If you're still confused, remember what Jack himself once wrote. Don't ask. Just buy. I will discuss the details of this chart later in the episode when we analyze the contents, but I do think it's a pretty cool idea to have a reading order. There are, in fact, two stories in this small, extra small issue, I should say, two 8-page introduction tales. We start with an untitled story in the Secret City saga, which was created by Jack Kirby, developed and written by Roy Thomas, and penciled and inked by Walt Simonson. He is called Walter here. This one starts in Gazra, the greatest city of the ninth men, in an age 15 millennia before our own. Their civilization has mastered its environment, not by the invention and use of machines, but through the development and channeling of human potential. A perfectly integrated society, its myriad parts making up an organic whole, perfect, yet doomed. For a planet-wide dark storm looms above Gazra and the other cities of the Ninth Men, as it has for months. Those are just the narrative boxes on the first page of the story. And then we move inside to the land, where an earthquake is ravaging it. And even in this enlightened city, there are things of which few know, and even fewer should know. One of these is the secret city. Another is the triad cell. The science circle is setting that Operation Tri-Arc into place. This is the process of placing three of their leading citizens into suspended animation. One of their three separate approaches might just succeed. The hurler, called Bombast there, for instance, highly unlikely that he'll be the savior of the Tenth Men, but who can say for certain? Or Nightglider, can we really be positive she will not soar on winds that, like her hollow bones, to the heights of a knowledge we'd prefer to keep to ourselves? At that point, a very colorful person barges in blue and white stripes and gold and yellow bodysuit. These are, by the way, the three characters from the cover. This one is Captain Kelton, and he will be the third. Whatever befalls, one of the scientists says, we know you will cover yourself in glory, as always. Take your place inside the pod. Spoiler, he will become the character Captain Glory. And below, we see that there are more pods, run by the Genetitron, a machine outlawed years ago and ordered to be destroyed. The science circle puts themselves in suspended animation as well, unknown to others. And then the calamity comes. Over the centuries, the dark storm dissipates. The face of the earth is covered over, where Garza once lay, by green verdancy in the cold, clear waters of a sparkling lake. In time, men dwell there again. First, a culture which has drifted from the north and west. We see an image of a Native American person in this panel. Then another culture which comes from the east, across an even vaster body of water. Between them, they give this site the name by which the Tenth Men will know it in their own last days. Chicago. The end. Next up is the story A Memo to Mephistopheles from Satan's Six. This was also created by Jack Kirby, written by Tony Isabella, with art by John Cleary and Armando Gill. This one starts down under. No, not Australia, but a place a little further down below, and hot, a little more fiery, kind of brimstone-y, if you know what I mean. We start in a scene reminiscent of Lewis's Screwtape Letters, with a head demon dictating a memo to Lucifer via his secretary, Molly Ringworm. And okay, that's kind of funny. The subject is Eden's ongoing appeals for five particular souls. Kuga, the Lion Killer, Desira, Brian Blue Dragon, Dr. Mortius, and Hard Luck Harrigan. In case you weren't counting, that's five. The demon's plan is to release these back to Earth under the supervision of Frightful, the demon in charge of their operations at Club Inferno. We learn that Frightful's 5 new charges, which together make up Satan's 6, are not terribly aware, but that they all have certain talents. And then in a series of 5 one-page profiles, we meet the vicious Kuga the Lion Killer, the manipulative and seductive Babylonian Desira, the headstrong and prideful Brian Blue Dragon, rejected by Camelot, the mad scientist Dr. Mortius, and the gambler Hard Luck Harrigan. Our head demon sends off his memo detailing to Lucifer his actions, and the reply is immediate. Molly delivers the word to her odious supervisor. It seems by interfering with the appeals process, you've allowed heaven to take a more active role as well. Hell's claim to the humans is now in jeopardy. Over the demon's groans, the secretary continues, there were also some suggestions of a highly personal nature, but you can read them when you're feeling better. Hold my calls for a bit, would you, Miss Ringworm? The end. Let's start by jumping back to that chart on the inside front cover. This is where the flow chart of the series resides. And it will explain these two very disconnected stories and how they relate to each other within the context of this group of comics. The flowchart contains 12 boxes, one for each issue. This issue, Jack Kirby's Secret City Saga number 0, is at the far left, representing the origin point. There's a box that literally says, "You are here." From there, we get 4 number ones, although this really represents 2 tracks of stories. We get Bombast, covered later in this episode, Night Glider 1 and Captain Glory 1, which will be covered next episode, and also Satan's 6. Those are the 4 number ones within this line of stories. The top 3, Bombast, Night Glider, and Captain Glory, then all funnel from each of theirs number ones. They then funnel together into Jack Kirby's Secret City Saga 1 through 4. While Satan's 6 number 1 leads into Satan's 6 2 through 4, I assume that there is an overlap between these two different paths, between the Secret City branch of stories and the Satan's 6 branch, but it's not obvious or clear that that is what is happening here. Since we are covering the SCS, it's too hard to keep saying Secret City Saga, that part of the diagram later in the episode and next episode, I actually want to knock out the Satan's 6 part of the preview first. And that story is definitely pretty. The scenes in hell are a melange of shades of red, very intense coloring, and the other scenes about our team members, each one has its own look based on that character and their personality and history. Very well done. And certainly the idea of negotiations between heaven and hell over these 5 beings. It's an interesting notion, certainly from a darkness to light perspective. And each of the 5 in their biography have points in their favor. Good intentions, or they were deceived or being used, not knowing that what they were doing was evil. There's enough subtlety and gray area there to make that debate over their eternal destiny believable? From a certain point of view. Interesting story, interesting idea. It's way out there. And obviously, some of Kirby's ideas certainly were way out there. On the other hand, the Secret City Saga has the makings of a more traditional or standard sci-fi or fantasy hero type of story. Now, that isn't a bad thing. And it certainly has some Kirby-style unique aspects to it, at least in this 8-page preview. And I have to say that that final page reveal that we were talking about a civilization buried far beneath Chicago, that took me by surprise. I was enjoying the world building of the first 7 pages, the cryo tubes, the secrets of the science circle. I thought that was all intriguing. I was looking to see how that was going to manifest, that betrayal, the secrecy, all of what we were learning in that part of the story. I was hooked into the idea at that point, when I was thinking of it as, I don't know, an alien civilization or something. But then when I saw the twist, I was taken by surprise and really became excited to see what was going to come next. And I think I'm going to go read that next one, like right now. But first, I'm going to play a promo, and through the wonders of time travel, I'll be back in a minute or so, but probably more like 3 or 4 days from now. But we'll also be jumping ahead 150 centuries to our current day with Bombast number one.
Here at Quark's, customer satisfaction is our primary concern.
I'd say we just found our way into a wormhole.
I'm Kira Nerys.
Lieutenant Commander Worf, reporting for duty, sir.
To the best crew any captain ever had. This may be the last time we're all together.
This will shortly become a leading center of commerce and of scientific exploration. For Starfleet, one of our most important posts.
It is quite simply, Commander. The journey you have always been destined to take.
Sensors are not functioning.
We've lost all contact with the space station.
What the hell is happening out there?
Shields up. Damage report.
Battle stations.
I'm Captain Benjamin Sisko. Welcome to Deep Space Nine.
Listen to the prophets. A Deep Space Nine Two True Freaks presentation with Sean Engel and Andrew Leyland.
And now with 100% more Paul Spataro.
And we're back with Bombast number one, which had a cover price of $2.95, meaning I acquired this book at nearly a 91.5% markdown. That beats paying 25 cents for a free book just between us. The cover, by the king himself, Jack Kirby, shows a guy in a red and purple suit with white trim in a pose reminiscent of a bowler. But what he is flinging at us is not a 16-pound bowling ball, but is a bomb. And there is Kirby crackle all crackling around him. It's a beauty, and it's total Kirby. My favorite bit of humor on the cover is one little notation towards the top of the left. Remember that all of these character-focused issues are one-shots, and up at the top of this one, and Night Glider and Captain Glory also, it says, "One of one, collect them all." Now, they probably meant the whole line, but if you're buying this issue, you have collected the entirety of the title, and I thought that was kind of funny. Collect them all by buying this one issue. Now, the inside front cover contains that same note as the issue we just talked about, with the one exception that on the chart, the "You are here" arrow is pointed to a different spot in the diagram. Bombast was created by Jack Kirby and developed by Roy Thomas. The story, Bombast Lives, was plotted by Thomas, scripted by Gary Friedrich, with art by Dick Ayers and John Severin. This note also appears. The Savage Dragon appears courtesy of Eric Larson and Image Comics. We start in Chicago, near the river, winding between the world-famous Loop and the North Side, on a raw early spring day in 1993. And the sprawling metropolis is shockingly and unbelievably rocked by an earthquake. The earth splits, and into that crevice falls a teen African-American who was involved in a drug deal, and his thought bubbles and speech balloons are full of jive-style lingo and other aspects of youth in African-American language. I don't anticipate including any of that, but know that it's there. Anyway, this fella falls into a cave and discovers one of the pods we discussed from the earlier issue. And he ends up releasing Bombast, the one in purple and red. For the rest of the issue, Bombast speaks and thinks in alien language, which is translated for us, But again, for the entirety of the issue, nobody else can understand him. But he is alive, albeit groggy, and he deduces rightly that he is in the future, meaning the early 90s. Back out of the hole, the junkie kid is immediately attacked by a gang of dealers and thugs. Bombast observes for a time until weapons are drawn, or as he thought bubbles, mechanical weapons of some kind. I was genetically engineered for battle, so let the battle begin. He tosses these bad dudes around, including one of them he throws a few blocks in the air, only for him to land in Lake Michigan. After that, he becomes very confused by traffic and cars, and is eventually approached by a police officer. But not just any police officer. He ends up having a throwdown with Officer Savage Dragon. And they have a pretty good fight, and we see that Bombast has the power to turn anything into a weapon, and his whip-like arms bombard Savage Dragon with manhole covers, stop signs, trash cans, parking meters, all that stuff. Wait, I'm caught in a junkyard cyclone, the dragon says. He does land a few good punches, and then Bombast flies off. I must find someplace truly safe to collect my thoughts. Now he runs across another being who he assumes is one of his people, one of the Ninth Men, although he's not seen anyone like him before. This is the metalloid being Deathflesh. But this being is not on Earth to help it, but instead to overcome it, to remake it in our own image. They fight, and eventually with the help of some wet cement, Bombast is able to slow down Deathflesh enough to get away and head back to the crevice from which he climbed. Perhaps I can find clues, or others, who will have the answers I need about my mission. All I know is that I must save this civilization at all costs. Downward he plummets, both desperate and excited at the prospect of filling the holes in his mind brought on by a 15,000-year sleep. He finds another empty pod, and then feels the rushing of a wind where there is no wind, by Gazra. The being that swoops at him is the mostly midnight blue-clad night glider. They begin to battle, but are separated by a third being. Stop this madness, Bombast and Glida. And then on the last page, we get a splash of these three beings. Separating Night Glider and Bombast is the being from the prior issue in yellow and red with blue and white stripes and stars. Stop this madness, or you'll both answer to Captain Glory. To be continued in the pages of Night Glider number 1 and Captain Glory number 1. So, what did I think of this one? First, let's address the character name, Bombast. Because I think it's awesome. It has the word bomb in it, almost has the word blast in it, and then when you put them together, see, here's the thing. For me, if you start listing the words you think of when you think of Jack Kirby, it actually wouldn't take all that long to get to Bombast or Bombastic. So it's a name that works on that level as well. It doesn't just describe the character and his powers, but it describes the creator's design style, his particular aesthetic, perfectly. Bombast. We do have to acknowledge the point that I hinted at before, the black junkie, and that is how he is referred to in the story. His language in Jive speak is, to be kind, it's dated. But it may even be worse than that. It's just not a good look, and I can't think it was all that appropriate and welcome even back then, a quarter of a century ago. And the other thing worth mentioning is the intercompany crossover. I am very curious how this happened, how they got Eric Larson to allow Savage Dragon to appear in this. Whether this was done at the top level, pardon the pun, of Topps Comics, publisher Ira Friedman or editor-in-chief Jim Salicrup, or the talent involved in the book, Roy Thomas, Gary Friedrich, whoever had that connection with Larson, that was actually kind of a cool scene. For one, it gave us a second fight scene without having to come up with an all-new second creation beyond Death Flash. This also had the nice effect of having Bombast go up against not just obvious bad guys like the drug dealers and Death Flash, but we have him also going up against a uniformed law enforcement officer. Yes, one that is big and green and has a fin on his head, but Savage Dragon also has a police uniform and a badge and a gun. So there is a nice presentation of Bombast as neither a clear-cut good guy or bad guy, or at least as far as he understands the world that he's found himself in at this point. You could see how people could question his motives in terms of his actions. And you get that by putting him up against a law officer, but one who is equally powered and can take a punch. And about his communication skills, I certainly hope that they figure out a way to communicate soon. I don't mind the misunderstanding, the stranger in a strange land aspect, but I really don't want Night Glider and Captain Glory and the other ones to fall into that same trap. I mean, anyone who's traveled outside their home country to a land that speaks a different primary language, you know, you can relate to what Bombast is going through in this issue for sure, trying to make sense of what he's seeing, what he's hearing, without the advantage of understanding the language. That's fundamental to interpersonal relationships. But I see that device could get old quickly, and so I hope that the following issues with the other characters deal with that problem, deal with that situation. Again, this, which is to say a lack of understanding, this is more realistic. So it is to be commended for that, but again, I do hope they dispense of this bit of realism, sacrifice it in some way for a smoother reading experience. Of the three main characters from the Secret City, I like Bombast's outfit the most. The helmet with its visor and other elements is very Kirby-ish. But I also kind of dig the purple and red color scheme. It's not one you see that often, but I think it works. A Night Glider's uniform is solid as well. And Captain Glory's, well, he's certainly colorful. But again, we'll talk more in detail about those two characters next episode. So overall, the story had some good points and showed potential. And all of that will definitely factor into my verdict. The verdict on Jack Kirby Secret City Saga 0 and Bombast number 1. Well, one of them was originally a free book, and I'm still kind of miffed that I had to part with a shiny new quarter for it. But the Kirby designs, the overall storyline, the pitch for this series, if you will, of these sleeper heroes awakening, I dug that. And doing so right here in the Midwest, I might add, a lot of that works and a lot of it intrigues me. So for those reasons, yes, both of these books, quarter bin deals. That wraps up our coverage of Jack Kirby's Secret City Saga number 0 and Bombast number 1, the first half of our Topps Kirby two-parter, bringing Quarterbin Podcast 145 to a close. Next time, we look at two more parts of this event. It's the two books mentioned at the end of this one, as a matter of fact, Night Glider number 1 and Captain Glory number 1, also from Topps Comics, and like these two, both cover dated April 1993. If you have any questions or comments about this issue, or the episode, any of the works of Jack Kirby, or the podcast in general, feel free to contact me. Until next episode, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the quarter bin. The Quarterbin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Short Box Showcase also make their home. Links to Facebook and Twitter are there as well. Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening.
Professor!